Making Queer History, Article 4, Christina, King of Sweden, by Harper Hugo Darling. King Christina of Sweden was a monarch born in 1626, initially assigned male at birth. The nurses would later retract this and assign Christina as female. Throughout the rest of their life, King Christina would continue to confuse and contradict gender roles. So much so that questions are still being raised today as to how to understand Christina's identity. In eras and areas where queerness is not discussed as an identity, any attempt to understand what words to use for a person's experiences becomes complicated. Many will say not to try and use labels in these cases, which is a legitimate perspective. Unfortunately, this perspective is often twisted to excuse or justify the erasure of queerness from history. When naming identities, self-identification is king, but when a person had no opportunity to self-identify under a label, all suggested labels are speculation. And while speculation is not fact, it is also not useless. Such is the case with Christina of Sweden. There is an element of interpretation at play, as there are many labels Christina may have fallen under. What is certain is that they were not heterosexual, cisgender, and androsex. The first thing that must be discussed is how to address Christina. For a period of their life, they went under the name Christine Alexandra, naming themselves after Alexander the Great. It is difficult to find when or if that stopped. While it is possible that they were still using that name within their personal life into the later years, they were publicly using the name Christina for themselves again by the end of their life. Since that is the most recent and most evidence, it is the name this article will use. As for pronouns, one could argue that any pronoun would make sense. There is good evidence to suggest they could have been a transgender man, a non-binary person, an intersex person, or even a cisgender woman. The use of they, them, their pronouns is meant to reflect that uncertainty, not to erase it. Some of the quotes used in this article will refer to them with she, her, hers pronouns, but considering the ambiguity of Christina's gender identity, they will be left unamended. This is not the first time Christina's gender had been a point of contention. It had mystified people since they were born. In December 1626, in Stockholm, Sweden, the nurses initially announced the birth of a son. It took a whole day for anyone to admit the child had been born with genitalia traditionally used to assign womanhood, out of fear for how the king would react. King Gustavus Adolphus had been trying for a male heir for some time and was known for his nasty temper. To everyone's surprise, he took the news rather well, and he decided to make Christina his heir, treating them as he would a prince. There are many theories of how Christina was identified at birth. Some suggest they were just a very hairy baby, while others believe they may have been intersex. An examination of their bones was not conclusive in proving this idea, but it remains a possibility in a long line of theories about their identity. Regardless, in being raised as a prince, they were given the best education and trained in the art of war. According to their father's wishes, they were crowned King of Sweden after his death, but they were a king like none had ever seen before. Having access to the type of education that people assigned female birth at the time could scarcely hope for, Christina soon became well known for their thirst for knowledge and intelligence. In a letter, a friend of theirs, Father Mannerschild, wrote, "She understands 10 or 11 languages, to wit, Latin, Greek, French, Italian, Spanish, High Dutch, and both Swedish tongues, the Finnish and, if I be not mistaken, the Danish. She can read likewise and in some measure understand Hebrew and Arabic. She hath read and understands all the ancient poets, the modern poets, both Italian and French, she hath almost by heart. She hath dived into all ancient philosophers. She hath read many of the ancient fathers, but commends chiefly Nazianzen. Her memory seems to be more than human. She seems to be ignorant of nothing and to forget nothing. She tires out daily I know not how many secretaries, to whom she dictates and corrects, turns over and finishes everything herself." Christina had access to not only an extensive collection of books, but the men who taught them were among the most respected scholars available, educating them well and challenging some of the time's prejudices in their discussions. This included questioning the religious rivalries that had led to the 30 Years' War against the Catholics. Soon after they were crowned King of Sweden, Christina would call for peace, which they achieved in a relatively short time. However, it was not a popular choice, and they were encouraged to be more like their mother, to sit back and let their advisors, and eventually their potential future husband, control matters of state. Christina rejected that expectation firmly. Though their time as ruler saw many advisors, it is clear that this was due to the value placed on knowledge and new perspectives, rather than a case of dependence. From the letter mentioned above, Father Mannerschild wrote of their position in regards to their advisors. "She says that it is a duty of her by her maker to take the best care she can of the concerns of the kingdom, that if things succeed not as may be wished, she shall have this comfort, that nothing hath been wanting on her part. She administers and finishes all public business herself. The ambassadors of Ponta Tates transact everything with her in person and are remitted to no minister or secretary. When she gives public audiences to ambassadors, she alone makes all the answers to them. It is scarcely to be believed, but it is what I see every day, that these very Swedish generals, whose names and arms have long made Germany tremble, in her presence stand speechless, and seem to be in great confusion. She was scarce 7 years old when she lost her father. Who could believe that the daughter, from the age 27, could so establish her power in a kingdom, the constitution whereof is pretty free, as to rule alone, depend on the wills and counsels of none, be under the influence of none, but alone administer, conduct, and finish everything? One of Christina's top priorities throughout their entire life was to surround themselves with art and knowledge, bringing people from all over Europe to teach and later learn with them. They befriended some of the most educated people of the time, and worked to learn just as much as them. By all accounts, they succeeded, amassing Sweden's library during their time as king. They moved the country from war and conflict to education. As part of their legacy, they established the first countrywide school ordinance and started the first newspaper, Regular Mail Times, which continues today as the world's longest-running newspaper. Through all of this, they also publicly challenged what was expected of someone in their station who was assigned female at birth. Father Mannerschild wrote, "She hath nothing feminine about her but the sex. Her voice is masculine, and so is her manner of speaking, her movement, and her gesture. I see her on horseback almost every day, and though she fits in her saddle as ladies do, yet she shakes and bends her body in such a manner as that one who is not very near her would take her for a man. When she rides, she wears a hat and a waistcoat after the Spanish fashion. Her skirts alone discover her to be a woman. She keeps but one foot in the stirrup, and yet she rides so heartily that none are able to keep up with her. One would think her flying rather than running. Our master, the King of Spain, hath desired her picture in a riding posture to be sent to him. Her riding garb is too far from being costly, that I scarce believe it is worth more than 4 or 5 ducats. At court she wears clothes so very plain that I never saw any gold or silver about her but a single ring. She takes no matter of care in decking her person. She adjusts her hair but once a week, and sometimes only once a fortnight. On Sunday she spends 30 minutes in dressing, on a weekdays scarcely a quarter. I have sometimes, when I was discoursing with her, seen her smock stained with many spots of ink, occasioned by her writing much, and even sometimes is torn. When she is advised to bestow more pains in adorning her person, she says that it is an idle employment." Christina was known to dress in traditionally masculine clothing and refused to marry and produce an heir. They were reportedly so vocally disgusted by pregnancy that their ladies-in-waiting would hide their pregnancies to avoid being fired. To avoid the fate the Swedish people wished upon them, namely marrying their cousin, they chose instead to adopt him and name him as a prince. Despite all the good they brought their country with their skill, they abdicated the throne to their adopted son after only 10 years as king. Aside from their disgust towards marriage and pregnancy, there may have been further reasons for their avoidance of men. This is where things get complicated. It is well known that Christina slept with Ebba Sparre, one of their handmaidens. They introduced Sparre as my bedfellow and took little effort to hide it. After their relationship ended, so did Christina's interest in pursuing any relationships. It could be that they were heartbroken, or may have been that they were somewhere on the asexual spectrum. One possibility is that they were demisexual, requiring a solid emotional connection with someone to be attracted to them, and Sparre was one of the few people with whom they felt that connection. In their writing, Christina would say things suggesting this view of love, writing, "People do not always love what they esteem, but they always esteem what they love." Or, "Nothing pleases, nothing touches, but the beloved object." It must be noted that the works of King Christina are, more than anything else, contradictory. So while there may be many quotes from them to suggest one view of love and sexuality, others seem to suggest an entirely different view. This, while making conclusions harder to come by, actually could be seen as more evidence to support the possibility of their demisexuality. Throughout their life, they interacted with philosophers often and can be viewed as a philosopher in their own right. And one of the things that interested them the most was the nature of love and passion. While those are not particularly obscure topics, the depth of their interest was more than a little remarkable. They had a fascination with the Catholic views of celibacy and the Virgin Queen Elizabeth I's life. It is also clear that this interest transferred into their personal life, as when they announced their decision to abdicate the throne, they said to their counselors, "I do not intend to give you reasons. I am simply not suited to marriage." This seems to indicate more than just a lack of suitable partners. Whatever the reason, they note in their memoirs that Ebba Sparb was the one love of their life. Even after their relationship ended and Christina left Sweden, they attempted to reunite with their dear Ebba, only to be blocked by the Sparb family. That said, it is entirely possible that they were an allosexual person attracted to women and just cut their relationships quiet as they got older. It wouldn't be surprising, given the number of nude paintings of women they had adorned throughout their home. It is clear, whatever level of attraction they may have felt, they had no interest in marriage as it existed at the time. They died unmarried, and as relationships with women weren't counted, they are widely considered a virgin. As for gender, they never settled into an identity, using both king and queen regularly. In general, much of their life was spent seemingly to confuse any historians trying to understand them. Their conversion to Catholicism, their desire to become a monarch again later in their life, and their belief system remain hotly debated topics. In some cases, though, it seems that the debate is made out of nothing. One of the more clear parts of Christina's life after abdication was their support of Jewish people and the Jewish community. Although some have become very invested in either erasing or delegitimizing this activism, the reality of it seems very clear. Christina, throughout their life, was passionate about religious tolerance, and one of the more popular theories as to why they converted to Catholicism in the first place was to increase tolerance for Catholic people after the Thirty Years' War. In their later life, they would travel and stay with Jewish friends, using their sway as a well-known and respected figure to support their efforts for change while also making a life for themselves. This is shown from things as simple and relatively small as sending letters to authorities to argue against the anti-Semitism that was affecting a Jewish friend's trading business, and as large as threatening the Pope that they would convert back from Catholicism if he didn't step in and stop the tradition of throwing stones at Jewish people in the streets. While not all of their efforts were successful, and criticizing their work is entirely acceptable, the criticism often seems odd, specifically trying to brush away all of it as a misguided sign that they were foolish and easily influenced, or suggesting that they only did this because they were planning to convert the Jewish people in their life to Catholicism. There is little to no evidence of either of these suggestions, so the motivations for these assertions are somewhat questionable as one pulls them into the light. That being said, criticizing, discussing, and questioning a person's life and actions in the past is not necessarily a bad thing, even if it can sometimes be used as a guise for other, less noble goals. While this article has suggested that King Christina was a transgender, demisexual person, there is also evidence to support alternate theories. An essential part of discussing Christina and many other historical queer figures is recognizing that discussing their identity is not inherently harmful. For one, they are dead. No one is outing them, endangering them, or enforcing a label when they have chosen another for themselves. Additionally, it is not harmful to their legacy to suggest that they were transgender, on the asexual spectrum, or attracted to women, because those are not harmful things. Ascribing modern labels to historical events and peoples is a part of studying history. Sometimes, a modern lens can lead to a better understanding of the past. As this article is not written in Swedish, it is already removed from the language Christina may have used for themselves. This argument against the use of modern language when examining historical events seems to come up most often when queerness is introduced. The word volcano is used when discussing Pompeii, but the citizens of Pompeii had no such word for the thing that killed them. In the end, it is better to tell a story with questions and no real answers than to never tell a story at all. Christina was a remarkable person, no matter what language they would have identified with today, and they deserve to have their story told as a whole. They loved and slept with a woman. They dressed in men's clothes and lived the childhood of a young man. They named themselves after Alexander the Great and were known as one of the most educated and intelligent people of their time. None of this can be removed without losing something incredible, the true, complicated, and contradictory story of a beloved king of Sweden. If you want to support Sharing Queer History, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/queerhistory. Thank you.